This is the Gentle Rebel Podcast, episode 315.
The Gentle Rebel Podcast.
For introverts, highly sensitive people, and creative misfits.
Hello, Andy here. Welcome to the Gentle Rebel Podcast. This is an episode I didn't expect to record. It is actually episode 315. I realised that I introduced the last episode as episode 315. I was like, I'm not sure there was a 313 or a 314. But, you know, that's just the way it goes. I have just edited the previous one and called it 314 because I think there was one in between 312 and the last one, but I didn't kind of title it 313. I've lost track of numbers anyway. It's all incidental. It doesn't really matter. But this episode was going to be a blog post, but then I wrote 3,000 words and felt it was a little long just for a blog post because people will not read stuff that long, or most people won't anyway. So I thought, you know, it would be helpful to turn it into a podcast and video as well. So the reason for this episode is that it seems like everyone is talking about the social dilemma at the moment. It's highly likely that people probably have never heard of it, most people, and yet the perception I have through my kind of bespoke reality feed is that this movie is being talked about everywhere. Seriously, I think it is in the top 10 things watched on Netflix over the past week or so. But I'll be honest, when I first heard about it, I had no interest in watching it. It didn't appeal to me really at all because I guess the premise appeared to be going over old ground. It was stuff that I've kind of read about and talked about a lot with people over time, you know, truths about the way that we've sold ourselves to technology, to social media, and the hype around this notion that we've bought a one-way ticket to the annihilation of humanity as a result. Do I really want to watch that? I don't know. But then I was speaking to my friend Jazz on Monday, and he'd kind of mentioned it. We were just talking about like stuff that we kind of wanted to recommend or had heard about and we're going to check out. And he'd said, he's heard of this thing called the social dilemma. He'd heard it's worth having a watch. So I thought, okay, yeah. So I opened Netflix and there it was, top of the page, full width spread. It was the, you know, the main thing that was like this, like recommended by Netflix, as if it had been expecting me. I'm not going to kind of go into all the weird, intricate ironies of, you know, talking about this on social media and watching it on Netflix and the algorithms involved in the things that Netflix recommends and all that sort of stuff. Obviously. But if you've not heard of The Social Dilemma, it's basically a documentary that blows the whistle a bit on the persuasion technology industry. And it revolves around testimonies, reflections, laments, even from some of Silicon Valley's leaders and kind of bigwigs through the years, the people who have developed, have been instrumental in creating the biggest platforms and technological features that we all know, most of us use. I wouldn't say we love, I'll go into some of that in this episode. There was nothing in the film that surprised me. There were no great revelations that I hadn't already heard, but I found the way that it presents the situation was quite fresh and will hopefully pave the way for some good conversations to take place. It's not a perfect film by any stretch of the imagination. And I think the idea that it should be is wrong. Like, you know, there is no such thing as perfection, as we've talked about many times. I never kind of intended to write, and certainly not to share thoughts on this, but my morning pages on Tuesday got a little bit overtaken by my reflections on what I'd watched. And I didn't think I had many thoughts on it, but it turned out that I did. Not least because it's, another piece in the jigsaw that I've been putting together this year in the wake of I guess, information burnout and news fatigue that really took hold of me about 4 months ago. This feeling that I'm feeling all this like hostility, this anger as a result of engaging in social media. And yet there's no kind of good or healthy outlet for it. And I feel like the more I engage and the more that I try and understand and I guess spread what I would say is truth, the more I feel hopeless in that situation. It feels like the other side is growing bigger and bigger. And so it's another piece in that jigsaw, because I mean, maybe you've been feeling similar, exhausted by the onslaught of news that makes you simultaneously furious and hopeless. The links, the videos, the trending topics, you know, are going to take you into a rabbit hole that leaves you feeling, I don't know, a bit grimy, a bit dirty, used. But you can't help yourself. You always end up there, and you don't know why. Despite your best of intentions, you seem to just fall into that trap. And it's made all the worse by the fact that you know it's bad for you, but something pulls you in and you just can't help yourself, literally. And the social dilemma is a reminder that this is not necessarily an accident. You know, we're moving deeper and deeper into a system which requires us to do what it manipulates us into doing. And when I finished the movie, I couldn't help but wonder, am I an animal on a farm? And I also began to wonder, is artificial intelligence really driving us towards this self-obliteration, or does it simply bring out into the open the stuff that's already lurking around and beneath and within me and within society and within our kind of social fabric and relationships more generally? You know, is it what already makes up the wider fabric, and actually social media just makes it more visible? I've got loads of questions. I'm interested in the power of resources like this film to stimulate healthy conversation. I think it's really important. You know, I've already seen kind of some cynical, dualistic, ideological teardowns. And I have nothing invested in this film. I don't think hype is the best reaction that we have to it. I've seen plenty of hype as well. People being like, this will blow your mind. This is the most amazing film ever. And it shines a light on this thing, as if this is not stuff we didn't already know. And I don't think that's helpful, because it kind of just feeds the very beast that we're looking at exposing through this. And so hype of any kind, whether it's the hype or the kind of backlash against it, just really feeds this kind of, it's almost like when you see magnesium burn and you know it will burn bright for a very short period of time and then we'll kind of forget about it. This is hopefully something that will stimulate longer term conversations. You know, I'm all about the slowing down and the allowing things to really marinate and kind of soak into us, and dig more deeply into these things, rather than this is the latest film. This is the film this week, and next week it's going to be about something else and we'll forget about that other thing. Because that's the whole point. That's really the reality that it's trying to shine a light on. And I think I'd like to build this episode of the podcast upon a certain foundation, you know, to put all of the ills and problems that we're experiencing in our world right now onto the shoulders of one thing is, in essence, the very problem itself that we are staring at. You know, we want an enemy, and it's easy, it's lazy, it's hopeless to say all of our, you know, dissatisfaction, all of our feeling like just crap is the fault of this one thing, it's this system, or it's this person. Instead, we should see all advancements and inventions and progressions as symptoms. You know, the interesting question that we can explore is, you know, what is this symptom telling me? What is it telling us? You know, in a democracy, an election result is a symptom. It's not the cause of a problem. It's the symptom of stuff that's going on beneath the surface. It's been going on over time. It's kind of bringing to light, bringing to the surface a symptom of something else that's deeper. The society, the popular culture, whatever is happening at that deeper level. And it's, in this sense, all a very messy web, loads of stuff going on, and we cannot point anything to one particular cause. And upon that foundation, I want to share some of the ideas in The Social Dilemma that I've found really interesting to kind of think about and reflect on, and stuff that I think is really important for us to really dig into in culture and in our own personal lives, in our families, and yeah, all our relationships, basically. So starting with this idea of product, you know, the idea that if you're not paying for it, you're not the customer, you're the product being sold, is a kind of a line that's been around for a while. You know, of course, by definition, if you're not paying for something, you are not a customer. And we don't have to look far to see examples of companies collecting data on its users and building accurate profiles that they can more kind of pointedly sell to. And for some people, this is seen as a kind of positive. You know, targeted advertising means that they are only going to see things that they might actually be interested in buying. And so gone are the days of being shown irrelevant adverts and posts and wasting your time seeing things that you're never going to buy. And for some people, this is something to celebrate, because it's like, no, actually, these filters give me the things that are going to interest me. But Jaron Lanier suggests that the idea that non-paying users are the product, not the customer, is a simplistic assessment that fails to see the whole picture, which I really like. He says it's actually the gradual, slight, imperceptible change in your own behavior and perception that is the product. That sounds much more terrifying. And this is where it does begin to get a little bit murky and confusing. You know, these customers, these companies don't just use our data to sell to our preferences. It's not like they know us to the point where it's like, if you enjoyed that, so I'm going to recommend this because I know that you'd really find value in this. And coming from putting our best interest first perspective. It's not about that, according to Lanier. The film argues that actually these companies are subtly manipulating our preferences, morphing our preferences, morphing our opinions, morphing our tastes over time with such imperceptible shifts that we don't see it happening. You know, it's this insidiously gradual change that happens, creeping beyond our field of vision, like the sleight of hand that we don't see the magician performing as part of the trick to shift something from one place to another without us noticing. And we believe we've seen everything as we think we've seen it, but actually something else has gone on. And the sleight of hand occurs through the use of advanced and secretly concealed algorithms in the case of persuasion technology. You know, increasingly intelligent and perceptive readings of what will lure us in, what will distract us, so that then we're more susceptible to that perception management, that information spreading, and ultimately parting with our cash as well. And so this subtle, imperceptible shift of perception and behavior happens through this kind of drip feed of information that's very carefully managed, carefully curated through these algorithms. I know there's been resistance to it by other people, but I kind of like the way that Jeff Orlovsky personified the algorithms behind the screen of Ben's phone. So in the fictional elements of the movie, the algorithm is brought to life as a committee of three blokes working to keep Ben looking and tapping and scrolling on his phone. And then this occurs between little auctions where they sold the fruits of Ben's behavior to the highest advertising bidder. And I mean, it was slightly abrasive in some ways, running the risk of turning it into a bit of a pantomime, which it may have done. But I'll be honest, I found something helpful about this image, because, you know, imagining The algorithm as in this kind of personified way, this there's real people plotting to predict and manipulate your behavior, kind of makes it easier to understand and more fun to try and subvert. You know, it's increased my own awareness of what I'm doing when I open my phone or open my laptop, and to raise my self-awareness around being suckered in to doing something that means that, you know, my personal algorithmic committee is all high-fiving and celebrating behind the scenes because they've made me do what they intended me to do. Obviously, it doesn't work like that in reality, you know, no bones about that. But it's potentially quite a useful image, a useful tool for some of us to use as a way to, I guess, locate some measure of autonomy and control over the way that we are interacting with technology or thinking about the way that we interact with it. I remember when Twitter moved to an algorithmic timeline. I think it was in 2016, and the experience was permanently altered. And I found my frustrations with the platform really kind of stemmed from there. I mean, it hadn't been perfect for a while. There were other elements that had taken it away from the elegant simplicity of its infancy way back when it kind of launched in those first few years, when it was literally just 128 characters and really just nice interactions with people before you could even like post links that would expand out and stuff like that. So yeah, and you'd only see the posts from people that you had chosen to follow. But when you no longer saw what others posted in order of when they posted it, it kind of changed everything. It became impossible to follow who you wanted to follow and to see their updates in chronological order. The algorithms presented a more kind of hyped up and divisive timeline, like by nature, because they began to display only things that gained more engagement. And as we've seen, like countless times, things that gain more engagement are generally more divisive or more kind of conflict driven, controversial, that kind of stuff. And so, you know, it was like, okay, what are people getting outraged by? Who said what to whom? And if you, the thing that's really got me recently is if you don't post for a while, it's gonna throw some recommended for you notifications your way to try prompting you back down the rabbit hole. And like, yeah, I mean, I've noticed this. There are notifications that you can't turn off. So this little blue number tells you, oh, something's happening. I better click on it and see. And it's like, this person said this, this person said that. And the truth is nothing is happening. You know, no one has spoken to you. These are just kind of baiting attempts to make you bite, to make you latch on and get put more of your attention into that platform. You know, our early bird Twitter account, we haven't posted much on. And it gets sort of like, I don't know, 5 to 10 at least new notifications a day, which are completely uninteresting. You know, someone you follow retweeted something by someone you don't follow. Two people liked a photo of a tortoise. Or like it says trending news. There'll be a notification to tell you that something is trending on Twitter. And it's like this clickbait headline that implicates a celebrity in some outrageous or completely mundane and boring act. And Facebook does the same. You know, when I check in from time to time, I'll invariably be greeted by a notification. I'll be like, oh, someone must be interacting with me. But no, it's just like telling me your post is getting more engagement than 90% of your other posts. Great. Like, thanks. I'm not interested. Like, I don't really care. What I've really got annoyed at this past couple of weeks, which I think my, again, it's annoyance that is being farmed into me and out of me, phantom notifications on Facebook. These are not mentioned in the movie, but it makes me wonder if that little red one next to my notifications on my Facebook page isn't a glitch. It's not an accident. It's an intentional, well, maybe it's an intentional bug, an intentional glitch designed to make me keep searching for what's causing it, because I want to get rid of it. And I cannot find any explanation for it, but it keeps me there. It keeps me looking, and it keeps me getting distracted by other things when I'm there. Notifications are these hypnotic triggers. They both mold and stimulate our brains. They pull us away from the thing we are focused on before. And, you know, before we know it, just a moment check turns into 2 hours of clicking and bouncing around videos, getting drawn into and angry at a debate between two people you've never met, never followed, and never really want to meet or talk to. And so we end up just leading these lives of drift, where we get sucked into things that we haven't chosen to do at a conscious level. I've always thought of social media platforms and search engines as tools, things we use for a particular purpose in order to achieve a specific outcome. And this is one of those things that made me think, oh yeah, that's a good point in the social dilemma. A tool is something, by definition, which kind of sits passively. It waits to be used. It doesn't do much else. Like my piano here, it's just waiting to be played. It's not monitoring anything or listening to anything or doing anything else in between plays. But when we pick up our phone, the apps, the platforms, the hardware itself may start to use and shape us. And what if it is, in fact, that we are the tool in this equation? Again, this is perhaps a slightly simplistic statement to make, because in reality, it is more complex than that. We can and we do use technology in very effective and intentional ways. But yeah, it's the subtle ways it builds a picture of who we are based on our behavior, values, and beliefs. So it's analyzing how we have been using the tool. This then changes what it wants us to see and do when we next use the tool. And so that's where this imperceptible shift comes in. So this is bigger than one individual, and it's a problem for all of us, ultimately. So these concerns are bigger than a single scapegoat that we can use to blame or from whom we might demand change. In many ways, and I think that's one of the powerful things in it, is when you see people like Mark Zuckerberg, who just appears completely out of his depth. This monster that he's let loose in the kind of case of Facebook is way beyond his ability to, put the genie back in the bottle, so to speak. There is no way to put the genie back in. And it's easy to generalize and catastrophize around all this, to create simplistic straw man monsters, baddies out of a particular platform or individual or group. But this is something for all of us to grapple with. As Tristan Harris says, the technology revolution is both a utopia and a dystopia. You can tap a button and a car will turn up at your door within minutes and take you where you need to go. And on the same device, someone might struggle with their mental health because their social media post doesn't get the positive engagement that they really kind of need to validate them, you know, at some level, basic human level. The belief in technology as a foundation for positive change in the world as well is at the heart of the work many of the speakers and many of the contributors in the film now do. They've kind of moved from those platforms to kind of ethical and problem-solving platforms that and companies that they're part of trying to instigate positive change in the world through. Now, we might question the judgment of those who created features and tools that became centerpieces of what we now see in this context as a great evil in the world. Just saying, there's an awful lot of people who say the kind of, well, I invented it in good faith. I never had any idea that this was going to turn into this, or it was corrupted by money or whatever. I mean, it might be nice in the film to see a little more responsibility taken, a little less kind of passing the buck and actually reassurance that they've learned some lessons for their next venture. Because more than anything, it concerns me that, okay, if you didn't see this as a possibility at all, then yeah, I will question your ability to judge things, and I fear what your next venture will evolve into, unless you've learned your lessons. I don't know. So, yeah, I mean, whatever we think of the technology itself, this poses a problem for all of us. There are implications that we all experience, and it's no good to simply kind of write it off in various ways. The film argues that the consequences are there for us all to see in the fragmentation of the fabric of our social system and ways of understanding the world. You know, it would appear through social media, everyone literally has a different truth, a different reality presented to them, and a different understanding of the world. More generally, you know, I've spoken to so many people, certainly after like the elections in 2016, who and last year, like just constantly, who had absolutely no sense that Brexit was going to happen, that Trump was going to get into power. There was no sense that that was even on the horizon. And that's because the realities that we have presented to us, if all we have is our filter bubble online, is a reality that doesn't actually represent the kind of reality of democracy, or the reality of society, the reality of general popular opinion. And that's concerning. And they point out in the film as well that the false information is 6 times more likely to spread than verified fact-checked information. And they put that down to because people find the truth boring. And again, I'm not sure this is a new thing. It's definitely not a new thing. There's something in human beings that loves a good gossip and a fun conspiracy theory. And we do like to kind of, you know, spread information. And we've done that for as long as we've communicated person to person. Way before the invention of the internet. I mean, yeah, it might be fair to suggest that these algorithms are using our most destructive tendencies, tendencies towards ourselves and our communities, against us. We are willing participants because we literally cannot help ourselves, but kind of, yeah, reinforce that system of spreading information that we want to be true, or that we find kind of fun and exciting to believe in. And then Tristan Harris takes us through the mindset that leads us sometimes to inaction. You know, you might think, well, you know, when I pick up my phone, I'm just watching cat videos on YouTube. I'm just, you know, connecting with people on Twitter. I call out the bullshit when I hear it. I highlight people who have outrageous views. Like, my behavior is hardly an existential threat. Like, and this is where we might be kind of sleepwalking to some degree, because that judgment is completely understandable. It's right. It's fair. Like, yeah, fair enough to call my mundane use of social media or technology an existential threat to humanity and to the world. You know, having an Amazon Echo in my living room, you know, that's a useful tool. To think of it as an existential threat, because you ask Alexa to turn the lights on or to play a bit of music, seems like a gross overreaction. But as Harris suggests, the technology has an ability, and perhaps is even attached to this purpose, to bring out the worst in society. And the worst in society is the existential threat. It's not the technology, but it's what the technology kind of enhances, exaggerates, brings out. In other words, the way we've set things up, technology is not bringing out the best in society. And I don't think there's really any argument about that. You know, swathes of social media shows just this kind of cesspit of bullying and narcissism and trolling and disconnection and general vileness. You don't have to look far to see people just being really horrible to other human beings. But what if that wasn't inevitable? What if technology wasn't like that's not just the inevitable shift that technology brings about. I mean, you'd think those who designed and built the products would be proud of them and believe in their value for the world. Yeah? Perhaps not so much. You know, there's a moment in the film again where the kind of those who build this technology are talk about, you know, the serious regulation that they put on the use of them in their homes with their families. They know how potent and damaging these products, these devices can be. And they know how susceptible they themselves are to the addictive power of these persuasion platforms. I couldn't help but think of the image of the drug lord who would never dream of touching the product that they've profited so greatly from producing and distributing to unsuspecting and often trusting members of the public themselves. And part of this business plan is like weaning people onto the product. It's creating the market, creating a dependency on it and a belief that life cannot exist beyond it. And this leads me to the final point that creates a whole new minefield to carefully explore that they talk about in the film as well. Personal responsibility, I think they allude to it. But I think, yeah, every time I pick up my phone and use one of these persuasive technology products, I'm subtly exposing myself to being reshaped, both physically through the kind of addictive programming of my brain, but also through the immersive drip feed that shows me a mirror with an image that isn't quite what it should be. And this kind of subtle change of that image that comes back from the mirror. There is always more on this endless scroll. There is always another video. There is always kind of just more extremities to disappear into. And it is like disappearing into that proverbial rabbit hole. And every time we resurface, there's just something slightly altered. But this shift is so small, it's so imperceptible that it's impossible to see and very difficult to track. I'm not sure this can be seen, therefore, as a black and white issue of personal choice and responsibility. You know, I could take the view that it's okay. Like, I know the risks, but I'm choosing to use this anyway because I believe the benefits outweigh the costs. Because when we're unaware of how those risks are harming us or what those risks even are, because most of those risks are not the risks we're aware of. And it's not just that, but the risks to society at large as a result of collective actions. Our actions are no longer just about us. They're about a potential toxin running through the bloodstream of democracy, which is by definition a fragile system which needs protecting. It needs constant renewed commitment towards at the best of times. And that's one of the beauties of democracy is its fragile state. It's the fact that we're all responsible for protecting it. So in that respect, it's bigger than just any one of us and our own decision of whether or not we're going to engage in it. And so that's where we kind of get into a conversation about regulation. You know, we have regulation in pretty much every type of legal industry. Reason being so that individuals and companies can't get away with harming people or harming the environment in which they're operating. But what's different here is that regulation for people is usually in place to protect customers, so customers of a product or a service, and to protect those people who are using the things that they buy or engage with, protecting them from any adverse risks. And as we know from earlier, the customers are not the users. The customers are the advertisers. So what about protection for us? Like, what are we again? The product? How the gradual, slight, imperceptible change in our own behavior and perception, how's that protected? Can it be protected? What does that even look like in this context? You know, at the end of the day, if that isn't occurring, then the customer, who ultimately it's their interests that are being really looked after, they're not going to be interested in buying the product, because the product is the gradual, slight, imperceptible change in our behavior and perception. And that's us. and if that isn't given to them, the industry shrinks. And you know, who in power in that situation is going to choose that route. And that the price we pay is mental, physical health. It's our belief in a better world, even our ability to imagine a world better than this one, as well as many of the freedoms that we might take for granted. And so it makes me think, like, is this more like an agricultural style regulation where we need to make the farming methods more humane and less intrusive, where we're looking after the animals, like you might have regulation around looking after chickens or like battery farming and all that sort of stuff? Can the farmers regulate themselves? Is it fair to expect that from them? There's perhaps issues with what is being passed off as healthy feed to us as the animals right now. Maybe that's what needs regulating. What goes into the food that turns us into the most valuable product? Well, things like outrage, hype, division, the extremities, gossip, hostility, name calling, public shaming, all of these things, that's what we're eating day in and day out, so that we can become that shift, that gradual, slight, imperceptible change in our own behavior and perception carries on happening. And we connect with that. We love those things. We have a real fascination with all that stuff, the outrage, the hype, the division, the extremities, the gossip, the hostility, the name calling, the public shaming. We connect, we attach to those things. But it's really bad for us. It makes us grow quite fast and high in respect of that product. It's really easy and cheap to produce en masse. So as long as the harvest is ripe, the customers are loving it, the share prices are going up, and everyone who matters is happy. Is this really as bad as it kind of appears? Is it as all-encompassing as it appears? What are we able to do to protect ourselves? What can we change in the systems themselves? And how can we raise awareness in ourselves and others of the ways we are being manipulated into shifting our perception for the nefarious purposes of advertisers, ultimately? Will we be able to recognize that what we think of as our free thinking, unshackled ability to see the truth is actually maybe our own self-directed foray into an algorithmic rabbit hole that produces a caricature that we believe to be nothing but 100% real? I mean, I can easily tell others how they're the product of this machine. I can, you know, like if they spout views that I find ridiculous, or I'm like, yeah, you're kind of, this is groupthink. You're saying the same thing as this other thing, and you've probably been exposed to this drip feed of videos that's gradually radicalizing you over time. I can say that easily about someone else. But if I can't see it in myself, then perhaps that's why and how it works so seamlessly and perfectly. I don't know if you'd agree, but I find it really hard to see in myself. Even though I know it's happening, like, clearly. And maybe that's why I'm dwelling on this so deeply. It's a quest to find how I've been, how I am being changed by these devices, by these platforms and apps. So, yeah, I mean, I don't want this to be a doom and gloom episode. I'm going to finish there and ask, you know, have you seen The Social Dilemma? What impact has it had on you? I'd love to hear from you about the film, about any of the kind of thoughts that you might have had in reaction to this podcast and that kind of stuff. You can leave a comment on the post on andymort.com/social-dilemma. Or email me directly, andy@andymort.com. And if you've enjoyed this and would like kind of shorter, like 5-minute reflections on little observations around building a life of meaning and creativity, dropping into your inbox each week, then head to andymort.com/newsletter, where you can find out more about my ongoing video series, Picking Up the Pieces. At least that's what you'll find there at the time of I'm recording this. Might be different in the future, who knows. I'm recording this in September 2020. So yeah, I'd kind of drop that 2 or 3 times a month a little video reflection that hopefully aims to give you a drop of something to think about, open a conversation, and hopefully some inspiration to set you on your way with kind of letting go of things that aren't really feeding, sustaining, or sending you in the direction that you ultimately want your life to move in, if that makes sense. So, great. Yeah, I mean, thanks so much for listening today. I'd love to ask you a big favor before we go. If you have enjoyed this episode, and I feel a bit weird about saying this after the topic of this episode, but the best thing you can do to support the podcast and allow it to organically find other ears of people who are searching for encouragement and support with these things is to give it a good rating and leave a nice review wherever you're listening to it. And I guess share it with others on social media. I fully understand after this why you might not feel that that's all that appealing right now. But I guess if anything in here has been a message that you think will be good for people to listen to, then that's an option. And it all really does help. I'm so grateful to all of you who do support this podcast in such a way, and my work generally. I really appreciate it. So thank you very much to you lovely people. And if you'd like to hear me kind of expand on some of the stuff that I've talked about in this episode, expand on things I talk about in the Picking Up the Pieces series, and play music and just take the shackles off and do unscripted episodes, then you can find me on Patreon, where you'll get the exclusive private podcast feed, Gentle Rebel Extended Play private podcast. Just go to patreon.com/AndyMort and you can find out more about the options for that. Great. That's it. I'll be back next time with another episode of the Gentle Rebel podcast. Oh, my voice is going. Until then, do remember that you are an artist. The world needs your art. Now go and make somebody's day. Goodbye.